Welcome to the Ends of the Earth from Yellowknife in the Northwest Territories. I'm Kirsten Murphy.
William Greenland is away this week. I'm Les Carpenter, and I'm filling in for him.
Thank you, Les.
Coming up on the show, five reasons you should care about Arctic seabirds, and wind power moves forward in the Northwest Territories.
In the second half of the program, what a new study says about the feeding habits of Greenland sharks, a physicist heads to the top of the world to watch the sunrise, and an odd case of missing mercury in the Arctic. All this plus music from Joni Mitchell, The Beatles, and Royal Wood. Let's get started.
Dr. Bill Mundevecchi has studied Arctic seabirds on Canada's east coast for 30 years. His International Polar Year project involved studying seabirds to detect climate-induced biological changes in an area that extends from Nunavut via the Labrador Current through to Labrador and Newfoundland. This project is part of the larger IPY-endorsed project called Ecosystem Studies of Subarctic and Arctic Regions, ESSAR, which draws comparisons between high and low Arctic sites. Kirsten reached Bill at Memorial University in St. John's, Newfoundland. He tells her about the types of seabirds he studies.
For the most part, we deal with species like murres and puffins, razorbills, gannets, storm petrels, gulls, and things like that. They're mostly birds that make their living not by scavenging, but by being completely dependent on the fish primarily, and in some cases some squid.
What would you say are the top five reasons that seabirds are important to the ecosystem, especially on the East Coast where you are?
One is probably just visibility. Of all the marine animals, clearly the most visible one are the birds. Difficult to see fish, marine mammals. When there's a perturbation, we often see dead seabirds. When there's a human perturbation like oil pollution or birds getting caught in fishing gear. Those kinds of things are often quite obvious to us. And two is because they're top predators and their conditions are really indicative of food web conditions that are much more broadly based in the marine environment. I think another thing that's really important about seabirds is when we think about climate change and changes in ocean temperature and ice, it seems to me that the drivers of that are going to be the cold-blooded animals, like the fish. And fish, because they're cold-blooded, they're going to have to move if that environment changes. They're either going to have to find another environment, and they have to be expert in this knowledge or they don't live. And a seabird, if it can't find food, essentially, it has about 4 days tolerance where it has to find food and eat or it's just not going to survive. And I mean, I refer to them as Olympians in terms of fishers. I mean, they have to have it because if they don't, they're simply not going to survive.
Can you give me an example of a bird who's made an Olympian effort to get food or to adapt?
One, the murres that we study, they dive. They actually fly underwater for food. And actually, I'll talk about that. A fifth reason, and a really important part of our studies with seabirds, is in fact the fish that they eat that we sometimes refer to as forage fish. And it doesn't have to be fishes. It can be crustaceans as well. But these are animals that play a real critical role in the food webs. So something like Arctic cod just feeds a tremendous number of animals, seals, whales, seabirds, fish, other fish. So they're kind of critical links in the food web. The murres that we study, if we're going to ask for an average dive depth for a murre, it totally depends on what's there. But, it might be 20, 30, 40 meters. But we found that they were going to depths well over 50 meters and then to depths over 100 meters and, maximum dive depths of down to 180 meters, like 4-minute dives. And we couldn't even fathom if there was enough light down there for them, to see fish. And just thinking of the pressure involvements of making an effort like that, to swimming down 180 meters, like two football field lengths, and then getting a fish and then returning up.
How did you measure something like that? How did you know they were going to those depths?
That's a huge part of our research. We're using what are called time depth recorders to record how deeply a bird dives and the different times that it's at different depths. And so we can even come up with dive depths, water temperatures, where the birds are going.
Bill, do seabirds migrate to the extent that songbirds and, say, geese or swans migrate?
Some do. But these murres actually don't move that far compared to, like, you know, like a shorebird going from the Canadian Arctic to South America. In Newfoundland, we've been tracking gannets. You know, they'll go to the Gulf of Mexico, so that's a fair movement. But for the high Arctic and the Arctic seabirds that we're studying, the murre, which are the dominant species there, the thick-billed murres, their movements are not nearly as great. So they're really dependent on, you know, fairly high latitude, cold water systems, even in the winter. But if environmental conditions change the timing of when the fish are available and the birds come, those kind of timing conditions are also really, really critical. And bird breeding seasons are kind of timed, particularly in the Arctic. They're timed to the big flushes of food in the spring, and there's, you know, big flushes of fish and open water and lots of phytoplankton bloom. And with these changes in the environment, you know, the timing of the birds being there and the availability of these peaks of the food are not as well matched, and those will be probably some of the most critical perturbations that we would see that would go from environment to birds. And that match is breaking down, you know, in a number of cases because of environmental conditions.
Is it correct to say that you have completed your IPY research?
No, it's never completed. Some of the Arctic birds from Canadian Arctic are going over to Greenland in the spring. A lot of our birds are just going out in the ocean, you know, and we always have associated them with essentially continental shelves and the food webs on continental shelves. And they're just moving out, you know, off the ocean, off of Labrador, south of Greenland, just going out into open ocean. So we always want to keep going. Newfoundland, you know, we're low Arctic. Our latitude here, our north latitude is 46 to 49, which means essentially we're as close to the equator as we are to the North Pole. But yet our environmental conditions are low Arctic. And the reason is the Labrador Current, which is this river of Arctic, you know, ocean river of Arctic water that just cascading out of Hudson Strait and Davis Strait, just washing down, you know, the Labrador, along the Labrador Shelf and going out into the Grand Banks of Newfoundland. So that's the driver. And when we do our studies here in Newfoundland and Labrador, we're considering downstream effects. Like, and I'll give you one. That'll be the last thing I did want to mention to you, is like we should hit, when there's climate change in the Arctic, we're going to feel those downstream effects, and we should be able to pick up on them, and we're going to be subjected to them. That was a really important part of our project, to have high Arctic study sites, but to also have low Arctic study sites, and to have them essentially connected through the Labrador Current and through that cold ocean current that, you know, makes us a low Arctic climate, even though we're at 46 to 49, 50 degrees latitude here.
It's fascinating work, and it sounds like it's work that will keep you busy for, well, it has for 30 years and perhaps another 30.
Oh, I hope so, Kirsten. That's such a good thought. You know, that's right. That's right. And I'll be 218 years old, but sure, yeah, we'll be at it. Well, you know something? That's what they say is the tragedy of climate change research, right? Is nobody lives long enough. Human longevity is definitely a limitation, for sure, yeah.
And let me ask you, when you're out in the field, is there ever a song that comes to mind, or do you think there's a song that represents the work that you do or the environment that you're in?
Well, there is. It doesn't have much to do with the environment, though. But, and I'll tell you, one, there's a pianist. His name is George Winston, and he has a song called Thanksgiving that's just absolutely beautiful. And the other one that I always think about, see, I always feel grateful, and I always feel free. And the other one, actually, it's Joni Mitchell. It's something, I think it's called I Was a Free Man in Paris or something.
Well, Bill, we're going to play a little Joni Mitchell for you then.
Sure. Yeah. Great.
Thanks very much. Good luck with your research.
Oh, thanks so much, Kirsten.
Bye-bye.
All the best. Bye.
They're trying to be a good friend of mine. I was a free man in Paris. I felt unfettered and alive. There was nobody calling me up for favors, and no one's future to decide. You know I go back there tomorrow, but for the work I've taken on, stoking the star maker machinery behind the popular song.
Mitchell and Free Man in Paris, going out to Dr. Bill Mondavecchi, a research professor of psychology, biology, and ocean sciences at Memorial University in St. John's, Newfoundland, one of my favorite Canadian cities. Bill's next project is an NSERC strategic research project in collaboration with the University of Manitoba, Fisheries and Oceans Canada, and Newfoundland Fishers.
Hi, my name is Elizabeth Catholic, and I'm from Flutzelgay, Northwest Territories, and I listen to the ends of the earth. And you should too. Marcy Chol.
For the last couple of years, the Aurora Research Institute in Inuvik has been studying wind speeds. The research involves a 30-meter metal pole, the height of about a 7-story building, with a series of wind gauges. Testing took place in Ulahaktuk, Sachs Harbour, Politoc, and Tuktoyaktuk. And the results are in, and they're favorable. The next step is, or could be, to install 1 to 2 wind turbines in each of those communities. Annika Trimble is the Special Projects Coordinator overseeing the Wind Energy Project. I spoke with her during a recent trip to Inuvik.
And in general, what constitutes good wind?
So we're looking for an annual average of about 5 to 6 meters per second wind speeds. And these coastal communities that I mentioned are actually, all of them seem like fairly good candidates for that, and seem to measure up to that quite closely.
Is this an area, as a rule, that does have a lot of wind, this region?
Well, certainly some of the communities are known for it, like Holman and Sachs Harbour are known to, you know, really that you have to be careful when you're walking around outside some days.
Do you need consistent wind? Like, it wouldn't be enough just to have
Well, that's a good question, because some people say, well, why aren't you studying this in Inuvik? And Inuvik sure gets gusty days sometimes, but it's, you know, those winds aren't consistently strong. Whereas in places like Sax Harbor and Ulahaktuk, you know, even if some months out of the year the wind speeds are lower, generally over the course of the year, they certainly measure up.
And so you have the preliminary results, and analysis has been done for a number of those communities. So what's the next step?
The next step is really to go back to the communities and say, this is what we found. Do you have any questions? And also, what do you as community leaders and residents, what do you want out of this project?
And what are some of those common questions that you get asked?
So some of the common questions we get asked are about the noise. People want to know how noisy they are, and they're actually quite quiet. Even from 500 meters away, the wind towers are going to be about as noisy as your fridge, which isn't very. They want to know about, you know, the possibility that these things may disrupt flight patterns in birds, and typically that's not the case because there's usually only one or two towers in the community, and birds tend to fly much higher than the 30 meters these towers stand at. So,
how much of a cost savings will this be?
Well, power bills, like at home, aren't really going to decrease, at least not in the foreseeable future. But what we think is that in the communities that decide to put in wind turbines, that when the power company, you know, can then purchase the wind power based on the amount of diesel fuel that power company saves. So this means there's not going to be any cost savings for the power company. However, there's going to be revenues generated, which they may use as they see fit for the benefit of their members. You know, if the turbines are successful after a few years, like, this is the key thing, that if more are added, then, you know, the prices could come down.
Right, one or two is not going to save a substantial amount. And you're in a position to make recommendations, but ultimately, who pays for things? Who decides who pays for these things?
I think some of those partnerships, it's up to the community, it's up to our project partners like ENR and ourselves or our research institute, how that plays out.
It's out of your hands, so you've done this, you've created the science.
Yeah, we're there to provide technical support and give the people options, but you know, it's the partnerships, you know, remain to be developed, and some of the communities may want to do it all the same. They may want to explore the options slightly differently than their next door neighbor.
Why do you think wind power is a good idea in this area, both economically and environmentally?
I really think that, you know, there's such a focus on the north in terms of climate change, and just looking at how local citizens reacted to our nation being in Copenhagen and wanting to see a really strong proponent there. I think that if we aren't doing things ourselves, then I'm not sure what that says about how strongly we feel about the issue. So I think that using sustainable energy source like wind energy is a great way to show the world, you know, we don't just want you guys to do something about this situation, but look at us, we're actually taking things in our own hand and leading by example.
And a lot of our listeners are actually outside of the Northwest Territories, so what's wrong with the existing power source at this point, electricity source?
It's phenomenally expensive. A lot of the communities are run on diesel generators. The diesel's often brought in by barge once a year, and our government subsidizes our power bills a phenomenal amount. However, our power bills are still just very, very high.
Could you say what an average, maybe family of four to six in Sax Harbor might pay for power this time of year?
I have no idea, but here in Inuvik, I live in a one-bedroom apartment with my husband. We pay about $80 a month for power, and the government is subsidizing that by $120. So that's just electricity.
That's not heat.
That's not heat at all. So, I mean, to hear people say that they pay $600 a month for heat in the winter is not a strange thing up here. Never mind what's being subsidized. That's what they're paying.
Is there any existing wind turbines right now as we speak that are actually
that are operating in the NWT?
Correct.
No, we are the last territory or province to get on this boat. We have wind turbines or wind energy being used in all of the other provinces and territories in Canada. So, and for the size of the NWT and, you know, just our fuel costs and our consumption, I think it would be great if more communities got on board with this.
And so when do the community consultations start?
Within the next few months. Yeah, so we'll be going to Pawlatuck, Sax Harbour, Willahoktuk, and Tuck is having their own meetings. They've been having a few this fall and also this in the next few months or so.
Annika Trimble is a special projects coordinator at Inuvik's Aurora Research Institute. Community consultations on whether to build 1 to 2 wind turbines in each of those communities is scheduled for the spring.
Snow can wait, I forgot my mittens. Wipe my nose, get my new boots on. I get a little warm in my heart when I think of winter. I put my hand in my father's glove. I run off where the drifts get deeper. Sleeping Beauty trips me with a frown. I hear a voice, you must learn to stand up for yourself, 'cause I can't always be around. He says, when you gonna make up your mind? When you gonna love you? Thank you.
That was Tori Amos and Winter.